Today's episode is brought to you by Malwarebytes Premium. Protect your computers and devices from cyber attacks 24/7 with Malwarebytes Premium. And go to malwarebytes.com/lock and code for an exclusive offer. That's malwarebytes.com/lock and code.
Technology policy, right, could be 8 zillion different things. One thing we did make the decision about is like to focus less on Congress because, man, that's just like, again, like I'll meet with those folks so we can work on bills and there'll be a big hearing, but like, you know, again, they've just failed to do so much.
This is Lock and Code, a Malwarebytes podcast. I'm your host, David Reese. Our main story today is about consumer power. We've been doing this show for somehow 5 years now, and frequently at the end of an episode, there's what I would call an attempt at reconciliation. After learning about bomb threats that were sent to an innocent person, or a virtual kidnapping scam that robbed a family of tens of thousands of dollars, or how our location data is being sold to cops without a warrant, or how a car company is claiming it can collect information about your sex life, or remember that Roomba that took a photo of someone on a toilet and then that photo ended up on Facebook? Because that one's kind of hard to forget. But after learning about these kinds of things, I make an attempt at reconciliation. Yes, bad things are happening. So what can we do to make it better? But it turns out that because many of the harms we discuss on this show are broad, are systemic, that what we can do to make it better feels small and honestly, sometimes insignificant. As in, yes, okay, using unique passwords and multi-factor authentication better protects me from being hacked, but shouldn't companies better secure my data overall? And yes, okay, I can use a privacy-forward browser to better obscure my online behavior from advertisers, but shouldn't certain parts of my life be entirely sealed off from monetization? This is why today we're going to look at the power of consumers, of you, of me. It can be easy today to forget that power, but it shouldn't be that way, because when we forget our wins, we forget what is possible. And that's actually what today's show is really about. It's about what is possible and what has to happen to achieve it. Today, to help us understand what everyday people can and have achieved, how people have most effectively concentrated their power, and what major wins we may have forgotten in recent history, we're speaking with Justin Brookman, Director, Technology Policy at Consumer Reports. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Justin, we are so excited to have you on the show. This is something that, like I said at the top, I have wanted to talk about for a while, because in doing this show, there are a lot of episodes that end on a dour note. And so I want to open this episode by trying to undo some of the pessimism, right, that even I kind of hold when I look at technology today. Because when I look at the landscape, right, I see a lot of abuses, right? I see valid claims that AI is stealing artists' work. I see that there are few consequences for companies that mishandle our data. I see that there are growing threats of using algorithms for really sensitive issues like policing or housing. And those are the things that I care about. But then I look to my representatives and I think, okay, what's the most important thing for them? And the quickest action I've seen as of very recent history is like a forced sale of TikTok based on who owns the data, right? And this isn't to call into question like TikTok or the veracity of those claims, but it doesn't feel like the things that resonate with me resonate with Congress. And so all of that is a huge preamble to say, I would like to see the picture a little more optimistically. And I just want to intro with, what are some of the biggest consumer wins we have seen in recent history, and how were they won?
Yeah, so I'll say I have worked in tech policy for, I don't know, 15 years or so. And it definitely has been frustrating at times. I feel like we're kind of, you know, banging our head against the wall, or like rolling the ball up the hill and it keeps falling back down again. But I will say, I mean, I think we have seen more in the way of actual tangible policy victories in the last 5 years than we ever did before. You know, you go back to like the 90s and the internet came out and everyone was like, you know, the Ira Magaziner and Clinton were like, don't touch the internet. Internet's awesome. And it took, I think it took policymakers a long time to get past that. And then Congress, because Congress doesn't do a ton, though they do more than they have in the past. But one thing we've seen is the states start to kind of pick up the slack, maybe starting with California. California, traditionally, is probably the strongest consumer protection regulator in the country. And so we started to see, like, you know, states actually pass privacy laws, starting with California back in, I think, 2018. And then we've seen, like, actually, like, 14 other states have passed privacy laws since then. And again, these laws are not as strong as we would like. And like, part of my job is to try to make them incrementally stronger, but they kind of are. Actually, just a couple of days ago, Maryland passed what is arguably the strongest state privacy law. It doesn't go into effect yet. You know, we're seeing, you know, tons of sectoral legislation, like especially, you know, health data after the Dobbs decision. We've seen like California and in Washington state pass pretty aggressive measures to protect health information. You know, we have like a pretty strong Federal Trade Commission now with Chair Lina Khan. They have been more aggressive in their enforcement actions, including around health privacy, saying any sharing of health data, we're going to consider that to be a health breach. And so again, it's not perfect. Again, other areas, like one area I've worked on for like years is the right to repair your product. And again, I feel like I was kind of like, you know, ranting on the moor and no one cared about it. But then like suddenly now, like, we, you know, California passed, New York passed it first, Minnesota, California, Oregon passed it like a couple of weeks ago. And so now we have the right to rush you repair our devices in ways that we didn't before. And again, these tech policy victories were, they're certainly not happening in the 90s, but they weren't happening really in the last 20 years either. It's just, we've finally seen, I think, the dam start to break that, you know what, they're not going to regulate themselves. And again, and it's scary to have states regulating the internet, and like, they can get things wrong, and they definitely have. But the alternative of doing nothing, I think regulators are finally starting to say, you know, we can't just wait any longer.
On the specifically the right to repair, because it's something I've heard about, it's something that I've heard folks advocate for, but I don't know too many people who would know about it just off the bat, right? And so what is the right to repair, and what have we gained, like you said, in the past couple of years with New York and California and Minnesota?
Yeah, and then, in Oregon and hopefully soon Colorado. So if, you know, you have your device, and if you break it, increasingly, you know, because like, there's software elements and bespoke elements that they insist that you go to them. And so if you break your iPhone, then Apple traditionally would say, well, come to the Genius Bar and we'll, you know, charge you $200, or maybe we'll sign you up for like a long-term care package. And like, independent repair shops have found it traditionally harder and harder to get the replacement parts, to get the documentation, to figure out how to fix it. And, you know, when you think about, like, you know, traditional repair, like, the biggest issue with repair is probably cars. And cars, you know, we've had independent repair shops for years. And, like, actually a while ago, Massachusetts passed a law saying we need to ensure that for cars. And a lot of the car manufacturers kind of agreed, okay, blah, 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 we'll agree to give, like, the diagnostic data to the independent repair shops. You know, it hasn't been perfect, especially as, again, cars are more computer-like now, and, like, Tesla probably insist on taking you to Tesla, but most cars you can still go to an independent repair shop. But with the law passed in New York State, and like I said, Minnesota, California, and more states too, these companies actually have to give over the information about how to fix it both to consumers and independent repair shops. They have to make the parts available so that you can do it yourself. There are some great outfits like iFixit that do like tutorials on like, here's how to replace this, your screen yourself, or here's how to like fix this smart device. So again, people have the ability to do it too, but also like your corner repair shop that fixes screens that maybe they were prohibited by companies' terms of service from doing it themselves. Now Apple and Samsung and it's not just phones, other smart TVs have to make available the parts to folks to let you fix it yourself so you don't have to pay whatever they decide to charge you.
I am glad you brought up iFixit here, right? Because they are, I agree, I think they're like a main staple here. They're such a fantastic like advocate for consumer repairs. And like I said, one of the things I really love they do is they will review a product based on how repairable it is like to the common person. And one of the things like that we've seen in recent history is particularly things like the Apple AirPods rank really, really lowly because they're just like super glued together. There's no real way to crack into one and fix, let's say, like a blown out speaker, like a blown out driver, or like replace the battery inside it on your own. You just have to go to Apple. And as a person who had a pair of AirPods that died, like it felt like 3 weeks after the warranty ended, yeah, I'm never buying a pair of AirPods again. Like it's that simple because they are inaccessible to repair. And so, yeah, I'm just glad that you brought up iFixit and particularly, you know, brought up this right to repair in things like this, right? In these consumer wins. What is happening? You know, you said there that you felt like for a long time you were just, you know, speaking up on a more and like, you know, essentially into the void, you know, with no one listening. What changed? Like what changed in all of these wins that they could become achievable?
Yeah, I think like a particular point in time, I wonder if really Cambridge Analytica was the big deal that did like, change a lot of the momentum behind a lot of this stuff. Because again, we couldn't get legislation moved anywhere. And then I think that was like there were national hearings and then suddenly people were outraged and concerned about the future of democracy. And again, Congress got very activated about passing a law and they never ended up doing anything. But I do think the states finally started to realize, okay, even after that, Congress didn't do anything. And so we started to see the states actually move on a bunch of stuff. The California privacy law was, again, a weird... California has a strange ballot initiative process where anybody with enough money can like put together a ballot initiative. And this one like real estate developer, I think, followed Cambridge Analytica and read about data brokers and said, this is kind of ridiculous. And so he like wrote a privacy law and spent the money to put it on the ballot. And that kind of forced the feet of the legislators in California. So they said, okay, we don't want to do that because, you know, that's kind of crazy. But like we'll pass something pretty similar if you agree to withdraw that. And so that was like in 2 weeks time, they quickly cobbled something together and passed a law. So that's like just an example of like one dude who didn't really work on the issue kind of forcing the hand of regulators to end up doing something. And again, that law is flawed and weird. And again, definitely you can tell that it was rushed, but it did like set the path for like, you know, okay, you know, the internet didn't shut down in California. Colorado's like, hey, maybe we should do that too. Maybe like, yeah, maybe people should be able to access their data or get rid of old data or turn off targeted advertising. And then we've seen like, you know, again, like I said, 14 other states have done similar things. Now, not all those laws are great. Like I think after we started to see some victories, like an industry whose position was like states should not be regulating this, we should oppose all state privacy legislation, started to see, oh, this is happening. Well, if we're gonna have state privacy legislation, we should definitely have weak privacy legislation. And so like there's definitely been some very industry friendly bills that have moved in states like Virginia and most recently Kentucky. But most of them are like not perfect, but I think well intentioned and make progress. And we're starting to see like in the members in each state, they all kind of want to add their own special sauce and say, maybe we should add this protection, maybe we should add that protection. And again, I think they are by and large getting better slowly but surely. But also, we're not, you know, again, most of them aren't even in effect yet. There hasn't been a lot of enforcement of it yet. We've definitely seen a lot of companies adopt like the most ridiculous interpretation of like any ambiguities to still do all the data sharing and targeting they want to do. But I do think the arc is bending against a lot of the worst practices.
what do these state privacy laws actually do? You know, because I think, like, I live in California, and I would say the number of people who know, like, the CCPA is, within even my own group of friends, is there is one. It's me. And so for folks who aren't aware of them, like, what would you say is the biggest thing that these privacy laws give people that they didn't have before?
Yeah, so at first it was kind of like three things. It was an ability to access data, a right to have what they have about you, including like the inferences they make about you. Two, a right to delete, like if you don't want them to have your data anymore, you should get rid of the data. And then like an opt out for like sharing or for targeted advertising. It's mostly those three things. But yeah, those are hard to use, right? I mean, access your data, you can send it to a company and find out what they have. And that's useful. You can learn about it. And the deletion rights are one thing. Opting out is really hard to do, like site by site. It's kind of hard to scroll to the bottom of every single web page you go to and say, don't share my data. And then they say, are you sure? And then it's confusing. And that's just not usable. And so we've seen like over time, like these states kind of iterate on these protections. And so now most of them have like a global opt-out. You should be able to universally tell every website you go to, I don't know who you are, I don't care who you are, don't share my data, don't use it for targeted advertising. So California added that a couple of years ago. Like most states have that. Again, we're still seeing how that's playing out in practice. I spent a lot of my time on that, so we can go down that rabbit hole if you're interested. But they keep adding more things too. Like now you have a right to correction. Sensitive first-party data, there are protections on in a lot of these states. And so, and like I said, especially around health data, there are more and more aggressive protections to stop folks from doing that. And now, of course, everything is AI, and you know, policymakers say, I want to do AI stuff too. And so the vehicle for doing AI stuff ends up being a lot of these privacy bills as well. And so especially the California bill, you know, has restrictions on profiling, has like they're working on rules around automated decision making and when your employer can surveil you and the use of algorithms to make controversial and important life choices, what should be the rules around that. I think the privacy debate has been like maybe like a slow burn for like going back to the 90s was like the first time federal legislation was really considered, but obviously it goes back decades before that too. The AI race is, and the AI policy race is a lot more recent, but we've seen tons and tons of bills out there trying to think about and address how we should be constraining abusive use of AI.
I'm glad you also brought up this opt-out thing, because when I talk about what rights people have, and then unfortunately it does go into like, well, you have the right to like opt out of, you know, third party tracking on each individual website you visit in a day, which could be hundreds. And it feels so weak. It feels so unsatisfying to say like, oh, like you have a right to go through a million forms that, as far as I can tell, do not have a standard format, do not have a standard template. You have the right to read through a bunch of information and to increase friction in your web experience. I have found that people aren't excited about that. And I don't know how to make them excited, but I wanted to touch on it that, like, yeah, it's a thing. I do it. I don't know other people who do, and I wish there was just a better way to message that or to achieve it. Like, it's not to message it. I don't think the problem is messaging. I think the problem is we haven't found a standard way to like roll out cookie consent forms.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating. That's all.
And it's hard to do. It's hard to, you know, so like, you know, like, I think a lot of like data usage is kind of intuitive and folks are fine with it. They go to Amazon, they buy something, and then Amazon shares their data with like Chase and like shares it with FedEx. And like there's some necessary sharing to make stuff work, and that's fine. It's like the secondary stuff is when they sell it to a data broker or like you almost buy some shoes and they follow you around the internet for a week that people want to address. And the question is like, how should policy deal with that? There is an opt-out, right? Like you say, but it's super tedious to use. It's not practical. We actually ran a study where we recruited people to kind of go to the California data broker registry and try to opt out of one company sharing their data. And it was like super frustrating. They had to accept cookies just to go there. They were asked to fax in their driver's license. They didn't know what was going on. Like you said, all the interfaces are different. And so it's like a deeply tedious experience. So that's hard. There's opt-in, but the opt-in can be annoying too. I mean, you know, I think anyone who's traveled to Europe, like every time you go to a website, please micromanage your cookies. Like, I don't want to micromanage my cookies. I just kind of want it to not happen. One idea that's gotten a lot of like uptick from regulators and from advocates is the idea of data minimization, which is like companies can do whatever they want that's directly in service of what you ask for, then they can't do anything else. So it just works. So like, you know, like, okay, if I need first party cookies to remember you when you're buying something, that's fine, but I can't share a data with Google or a data broker. And so, like, you know, taking as much of the cognitive burden off of consumers as possible. You know, the laws, I think, are getting closer to that. The laws talk about data minimization, but it's not quite in effect yet. But I mean, I think I think is probably the right approach. Like, it should work. You should be able to trust that they're doing the data processing that's reasonably necessary. There's probably some back-end stuff you don't really understand to stop fraud and, you know, security and accounting and whatnot. But all the stuff that you're worried about is prohibited from happening. Companies should be doing right by you as a matter of law. Absent that becoming law, well, we spend our time on is trying to make the opt-out rights, which, again, most of these states are opt-out based. All the states are opt-out based for most data to make them usable. And so I mentioned, like, the global privacy control, which is something that is a web extension. It's available in some browsers too. You mentioned privacy protected browsers. These by default will send it to everyone, but just kind of tells everyone, whoever you are, I'm exercising my rights, whatever they are. Don't share or use my data for targeted advertising. You know, another thing that Consumer Reports has been working on is a product called Permission Slip. You can download it for free, and, like, we can kind of try to help you, you know, manage access and deletion and opt out rights for you. And so if you want to know all the companies that have your data, here's how to do an access request. We will send your opt out request to Home Depot or Amazon or Tesla or whoever to try to make it more manageable. Again, I think I would just assume a lot of this be illegal by default, but absent more aggressive laws, trying to find technological ways to make rights more usable is something that we try to spend some time on.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about policy, right? We've talked a lot about interpretation of policy, creation of policy, the whole issue in California. A real estate developer was like, I'm going to buy a law, you know, essentially. And then, you know, that forces policymakers' hands. But all of this is to say, so many things we've talked about involve the government, right? And yeah. I think of the same thing sometimes, right? I was like, in preparing for this episode, I was like, oh, what are consumer wins, you know, historically? And, like, I always fall back of, like, getting rid of, like, leaded gasoline, which it's strange that the thing I fall back on happened long before I was born. And then, like, I also think of things like asbestos, you know, like removing it. And even then, the US was, like, super late to that. But I also think of things like creation, like the very creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that happened in, like, 2011. All of these things, though, all of these are feats of government. And so my question is, can consumer victories even happen without the government? And if so, what are some examples?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, self-defense measures, we have seen the rise of ad blockers or tracker blockers over the last 10, 15 years, which, again, are probably the most effective way to stop tracking right now, just not let it happen in the first place, as opposed to sending along a legal request and hoping it gets honored. But even apart from that, I mean, I think in some ways the writing's on the wall, and we have seen a lot of the big tech intermediaries, like, you know what, my customers don't like this. Maybe we should find a way to stop tracking ourselves. And so, like, you know, Apple and iPhone is probably the most famous example. They've done a lot of things to stop, like, the third-party targeting ecosystem. And so that by default, most tracking doesn't happen. The Safari browser, going back historically, had always done a pretty good job about blocking a lot of tracking. Now we've seen the development of even more privacy-forward browsers from, like, DuckDuckGo and Brave to take more steps. And, like, and all the browsers, I think, have taken more steps toward blocking tracking. Even Google, who, you know, relies on tracking for a lot of their products, has said they're getting rid of third-party cookies. It's taken them forever, and they're trying to replace it with things that might just be as bad. But they feel the pressure, too, and I think there is some recognition that this tracking is in some ways the original sin of the internet. And, you know, in some ways it's, you know, we're trying to put the genie back in the bottle or toothpaste back in the tube, but, like, it's hard, but we have seen progress toward doing it. And I think the market is, I think, finally listening to the angst that a lot of consumers have that, no, we don't necessarily need this tracking to make the internet work.
I hear those stories. I like those stories because I'm privacy-minded. I'm into this stuff, but I'm also, I don't know why, I also have this feeling where, like, I don't believe it. Like, I don't believe in companies doing something because it's good. I have a very, very dim view of, like, corporate responsibility. And, like, I feel like companies don't do things that won't make them money. And I wonder if, like, privacy, stopping tracking just became attractive for a certain like market demographic that wasn't there before. You know, like I use Brave. I trust the people who make Brave, but I wonder if at some level like Google is quote unquote getting rid of third-party tracking. Like you said, they're implementing other systems that could also reveal a lot of information about you. And I wonder if Google is doing that because they're saying, we don't like that David's on Brave. We want David to come back to Chrome. Brave is Chrome-based, so it doesn't matter at the end of the day, but Google doesn't get that tracking from it. And so that's where I'm coming from. I don't know how you feel about that.
No, I think it's a fair concern. Like, and I don't think these companies are doing it out of the goodness of their heart necessarily. I mean, I think some of like the companies where privacy is they're raising debt, the founders just believe in it. Though also maybe they see that there is an angle to make some money. And again, I think the companies like Brave and DuckDuckGo have been fairly successful. But no, I don't think Google's doing it because it's the right thing. But I think that's actually a good thing. It's like Google's like, oh, we're going to lose market share. And like that, I mean, that's maybe the most optimistic way. Like, so therefore, we have to constrain tracking in order to do it, in order to get people back. Yeah, I don't think that'll be enough. And that's why I spend a lot of my time on policy. But I think it's a great sign if, again, some of these companies that do depend on tracking for a lot of revenues feel the need to make changes in order to respond to the marketplace, not necessarily because it's the right thing to do, because they're going to lose in the marketplace otherwise. I also think that some of the concerns are if they don't do it, then government's going to do it for them. And again, we've definitely seen lots of effort to constrain tracking, especially in Europe, but also here in the United States. So maybe they see the writing on the wall, want to do it in their own way, and maybe more importantly, at their own pace. I definitely think there's a lot of privacy greenwashing in the world where like, yes, we are super private, but in fact, like, no, you're not actually all that private. And like, there's not a lot of like clear rules on when you can claim to be privacy forward or whatnot. Though at some point it became sufficiently deceptive. I think the Federal Trade Commission or a state attorney general could go after especially obnoxious greenwashing. But I do think there are market pressures there, and the combination maybe of market pressures and regulatory pressures and actual regulation, I think, will help. I mean, again, I do think regulation is actually probably necessary to address this. I think technologically, data is just easier to collect and store indefinitely and process, and sensors are getting better, and cameras that were good from like 20 feet are now good from 50 feet or now good from 100 feet, 1,000 feet, a mile away. I'm reading Kashmir Hill's book on facial recognition now about Clearview AI and how like they just, the technology's there. Some of the big companies like maybe Google and Facebook were scared to go down that road, and Clearview AI is kind of like Leroy Jenkins, like, yeah, let's do it. But I mean, like, if not Clearview AI, then someone's going to do it. The technology is there. There have to be legal constraints on someone putting an X-ray vision outside my house, which maybe 20 years ago was like prohibitively expensive or not possible. But now the sensors are there. There need to be constraints and legal consequences when people do cross that line.
I understand this next question is kind of enormous, and it could probably fuel like a whole episode, but I think it's important because we're talking so much about technology, and we're even talking about, like you said, advancements in like cameras, and all of this relates back to, I feel, the internet, like the accessibility of all this information. And so the question is, how has consumer protection and like consumer power, how has that changed with the internet?
Yeah, it is a lot of questions. In some ways, definitely for the worse, in that I think a lot of these giant tech companies now have so much power. And again, you look at the leading, the biggest companies in the S&P or NASDAQ or market cap or whatever, and they're all by and large giant technology companies, which are then necessarily harder to regulate, and they have a lot more power. And you know, we've pushed, we haven't talked about competition policy, but you know, we spent a lot of time in the last couple of years pushing Congress on antitrust law, and then kind of womp, it didn't work out. And so again, and like, you know, we are seeing again this FTC be more aggressive to try to constrain the power of these giant companies and, you know, regulators overseas as well. I also, you know, think that the internet has made privacy worse for you know, obvious reasons, and it is easier for companies to get more and more information about us, and then potentially to manipulate us too. I think that the development of AI will be interesting if there's already a huge imbalance between companies and consumers right now. if companies have like the better AI and then can like micro target because they know exactly what pushes my buttons, or they know how much money is in my bank account, so they know how much money exactly I'm willing to pay. I do worry about the power of technology and AI and like unlimited A/B testing, that it does like wrest more and more power away from consumers. You know, because the more optimistic side is there is this democratization of information now. And so like the you know, there is more information about what are tools that you can use to make this better. This is a consumer power discussion, but obviously that's a question about like, you know, political and authoritarian power too. Does the internet empower authoritarians, or, you know, because I think, you know, originally in the wake of the Arab Spring, like, oh, this will make all information free, it'll make us all more equal. And then I think now we're seeing, maybe not. And so again, by the consumer's power side, I do worry that it does empower and embolden and entrench some of the biggest companies. But I think, you know, like you squeeze one side, and I think that does then put more pressure on regulators than to take more action too. And like I said, we have seen more willingness to do so than in the maybe happy-go-lucky 90s when like, oh, wow, this is cool and shiny. I can see my friends in ways I haven't before.
You touched on something that I struggled with myself in prepping this episode. You touched on competition policy. That is to say that consumer power within the technology space, and I think consumer power throughout history, isn't like one thing. It isn't, okay, like we're going to approach it through anti-competitiveness, right? Like Apple has dominance of the market. And it's also not, oh, we're going to attack it through maybe gig economy companies are committing labor abuses. And it isn't just like, okay, data breaches are releasing private information. Like, it's not just a cybersecurity issue. It's not just a data privacy issue. It's not just a labor issue. It's not just a competition issue. It's sort of everything. And I actually was very curious, how do you sort it all out, right? How do you decide, okay, this is the lever we pull for this issue? It just seems so enormous to me. It honestly feels kind of overwhelming sometimes. And I think, I wonder if people feel the same way. Like, well, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, so again, my job is I'm an advocate, and I kind of have like a lot of free reign in my role. Like, well, what am I going to work on day to day? And like, you know, in technology policy, right, it could be 8 zillion different things. One thing we did make the decision about is like to focus less on Congress, because, man, that's just like, again, like I'll meet with those folks, so we can work on bills, and there'll be a big hearing. But like, you know, again, they've just failed to do so much, and so we think it was an issue to kind of like prioritize California, where, you know, Consumer Reports has had a long history, and we have good relationships there, and we've seen, again, like, you know, I work on technology policy, but we've seen wins on like food policy. Talk about, you know, like getting rid of leaded gasoline. You know, there's still fights around like additives and Skittles and like lots of things. And Consumer Reports has done a lot of work on other issues like food safety and like product safety. And again, trying to find the levers that I think are likely to work. You know, Congress is tricky, though. Again, like now suddenly there's tremendous interest in privacy legislation again. And I feel a little bit like Charlie Brown in the football. Do I run up and try to kick it, or just go find a different game? But I mean, there's potential there for something really strong. And there's also a fear that if Congress passes actually, you know, weak or mediocre legislation and then preempts the states from iterating on that over time, that actually might be a net loss. And so that's something that we actually have to spend a lot of time on. And then aside, like, we spend a lot of time working on tools, again, to make these rights more accessible to folks. And that's like, you know, the technology side is something that Consumer Reports is fortunate enough to have some resources to try to help develop, to try to make these things more workable for folks. Again, like, we have actually pretty strong, very well-intentioned regulators right now, the Federal Trade Commission and on other areas like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Incredibly strong leadership. You know, in some ways, a lot of these agencies have been beaten down over time, especially the Federal Trade Commission, where I actually spent a couple of years, has just far fewer resources than it did, like, even in 1980. And like now they have, like, the economy is so much bigger. But they are also trying to find the levers within the agency and kind of going through old statutes and say, oh, hey, here's something we can do we haven't done in 50 years. Let's try this. And so we work with them to try to, like, find ways to make that usable and actually meaningful. And again, I think the most important thing is there is, I think, actually, yeah, I'll say even bipartisan interest in recognition in regulating tech in ways there certainly wasn't before. Like, I would say, like, 20 years ago, it was the traditional Democrats, let's do less regulation. And then the Republicans were like, no, let the market take care of it. That's not the case anymore. I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of red states pass legislation on their own on social media. And again, query whether you think it's good or bad, but there is a willingness to intervene in ways there certainly wasn't before. And there has been, I think, bipartisan consensus on or at least closer to consensus, on things like privacy and competition. Maybe not enough to do all the things that I want to do. But we have seen, like, you know, red states like Texas and Montana pass actually some of the better private state privacy laws that are out there. It's just not enough for like a big tech company to show up and say, hey, you know, you're going to stifle innovation. Like, that argument, I think, worked a while ago, but I think not as much anymore.
I wanted to talk about how you were saying, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into prioritization. There's so much stuff that Consumer Reports does that also isn't technology, right? A lot of food-based work. And this is something that I'm like morbidly curious about because we see it in our own work at Maurabytes, right? Maurabytes is a founding partner of the Coalition Against Stalkerware, trying to fight stalkerware, trying to detect it, remove it, educate people on what it is, give them all the tools they need, all the resources to get rid of it. And we have found that, like, in talking about the abuses that can come, like, from stalkerware, but also just like how to have a safe relationship today, like a safe relationship, a romantic partnership with technology, like in their lives, like in someone's life. We talk a lot about, like, hey, location tracking could be bad, you know, like location tracking, like non-consensual location tracking is bad. This is just bad stuff. And so we always warn people about location tracking with a romantic partner. We just warn people about it. And we have found that people really like that stuff. People in healthy relationships where there is no abuse, they love location tracking. And that's really hard for me to accept. Like, that's something that I just have to learn about. And so my question after all of that is, are there issues that Consumer Reports that you folks have thought, like, this is going to be it, this is a big one, and then the public says, nah, not really? And if that's happened, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, privacy, I mean, general commercial privacy was like that for a while. That we wrote a paper about this, about consumer attitudes about tracking for a while. And at first, like when the internet first came out, people were kind of scared, like, oh my gosh, I would never do online banking. And then, like, people kind of got used to it. And like, I'm going to put every picture of myself drinking online. And like, what could go wrong? And then that kind of peaked around, like, maybe 2010, 2011. And then, like, I think ever since then, people have kind of started to get more and more nervous about it. I mentioned, yeah, Cambridge Analytica. And people kind of start to see all the ways that these things can go badly. And so, again, I was always saying, no, it could go badly. And like, I don't take a lot of credit for convincing folks. I think just like technology evolved and people saw how it mattered to their lives. And again, now there is, I think, broadly, you know, consensus that, okay, this is all too much. And so we don't do a ton of work on stalkerware. We are focused on, you know, commercial relationships and your relationship vis-a-vis companies. But it is like hugely important. I have a ton of respect for, like, you know, EFF and Eva Galper and the people who do a ton of work on that issue. I will say my colleague, Yale Grauer, who's a reporter and who works for us on another product we have called Security Planner to kind of help people understand, like, you know, the threats to their lives and the basic things they can do to address that, has done a ton of work on that. And Security Planner, again, does try to give concrete advice to folks and explain to folks, like, security in general is something that I think folks have trouble wrapping their head around. In general, consumers are really bad about evaluating tail risk, right? Like, the very small chance of something very bad happening, which is why Consumer Reports 50 years ago had to push to mandate seatbelts in cars, because people just, yeah, what could go wrong? The odds of it about 1%. Well, yeah, 1%, but that 1% is deeply terrible. And I know Yale also, like, runs like the big ass data broker opt-out list. There's so many services out there where you can go and say, hey, where does this person live? Often based on publicly available data. And, like, you know, she runs that service to try to, like, help people, like, say, okay, get your name off as many lists as possible. And again, some of these new laws do help that make it more easy. Sometimes there's a lot of exceptions for data that came from a public source. But again, I think some general recognition about things can go wrong. So I think in general, attitudes are shifting to being more concerned, but certainly not everywhere. And people definitely have, still broadly differing opinions on this. Like, you know, I definitely have family relatives who, like, just pull up their phone and say, oh, I wonder where my husband is right now. And, you know, she'll pull it up and, oh, there he is. He's at the store, which is, like, not the way I would think I want to. But I mean, like, you know, like, again, I mean, It is like reassuring. I'm making fun of it, but I do it for my kids. My 12-year-old who takes the metro to school 5 miles away, I'll pull it up and say, yeah, did he get to school today? So again, we all have different appetites. Even privacy advocates are still tracking their children ferociously.
Yeah. Unlike the idea that, you know, some people accept these things into their lives. And like you said, particularly with like tracking and not location tracking, but like online tracking, online ad tracking, I feel like I die a little bit each time I read someone say, or I hear someone say that they prefer targeted ads to non-targeted ads. They're like, well, if I'm going to get ads, they might as well be things that are relevant to me. Because I feel like non-targeted ads don't ruin my life in any way whatsoever. I'm not upset by them. I don't take umbrage with them. I'm not like, oh God, I can't believe I got this ad and it's not relevant to me. That's how life was for so long.
Yeah.
That's what a commercial is on TV. Like I watch Jeopardy and every commercial is for people 70 and up. I'm not upset by that. That's completely normal to me. And so, yeah, every time I see someone say like, well, I'd rather have, I don't even think of it as an equation. And yeah, we have also found that people really accept online ad tracking. People really, I would go as far as to say, like, they've fallen for the lie. They fall in for the lie that targeted ads are good. Because I think it's a lie. I don't actually think it's valuable. But that's me.
Yeah. I think some people have. I do think the attitude has changed over time. Cambridge Analytica being a good example about, like, I think, you know, people say, well, it's just an ad. Like, what's the worst behind it? And then people don't think about all the tracking and the collection of data and sharing of data that could lead to it. Again, I think Dobbs was another moment, like, where people realize, oh, maybe everyone should not be sharing information about my geolocation or, you know, what prescriptions I'm getting. It makes it very visceral to people. Like, okay, this is not just about ads. This is about the whole tracking infrastructure behind it. And again, tail risk of, like, you know, like a very small chance that something bad might go wrong. So again, there are definitely plenty of people who are fine with targeted ads, but I would say they're probably less than they were 5 years ago, and then less than they were, like, you know, in far less than they were maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah. I wanted to close out here with a question just about, you know, for the folks who are listening, let's say there's a disillusioned listener today who is still wondering, okay, what do they do? What are some of the levers they can pull on to get change to occur?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the advice, like, a lot for how to change the world is often, like, you know, act local, right? And, like, in tech policy, that was actually impossible for a bunch of years because no local member is going to do anything about it. And that has, like, definitely changed. You know, I think the states are where most of the action is. Localities, too. Like, you know, New York passed a law about, you know, companies using algorithms to, like, you know, sort resumes and to, like, you know, pick and choose winners. So New York City is passing laws. And, you know, like, lots of certainly bigger, bluer cities are addressing things like facial recognition. Again, but in ways that no one was ever doing before. And it's also, you know, interesting that, you know, in a lot of these states, it's often just like one member who, like, decides, like, you know what, we're going to have privacy legislation. And I'm going to, like, you know, use my limited power to make that happen. And it's very member driven, one person. And so, again, if you find the right member to, like, you know, be that champion, and again, it doesn't have to be privacy legislation. Like, there's so many issues, like AI is certainly another one. But, like, it could be, like, you know, non-consensual intimate images, location tracking. We're seeing states start to consider legislation around that. We've seen new legislation on health privacy. Talk to someone local, you know, work on the, maybe you should do a bill here. And then, like, this maybe feels like less satisfying in some ways, but, like, we are seeing, like, you know, like bigger federal efforts to try to change things. The Federal Trade Commission has various rulemaking things that they have in the works. On right to repair, for example, including on repairability scores, like, mandate those, on commercial surveillance, on AI impersonation, on lots of issues. And, like, you can comment on those. And it sounds a little bit silly, but, like, the comments matter. Like, you know, we've actually, and, you know, we do this for a living, and so, and we have good relationships, and so maybe that helps us kind of push things in certain directions. But they care about what people say. They are legally required to read and consider and address what people say to them. And so, like, you know, if someone says, like, here's something to think about on banning AI impersonation that maybe you hadn't thought of before, you can change things. And, like, this is a very open-minded FTC that wants to change things. And so that's another potential vehicle, taking advantage of, like, a regulator who, like, is trying really hard to do a lot of really cool but difficult things, can maybe, like, you know, help nudge them in the right direction.
I'm glad you brought up the commenting procedure, right, for, like, the FTC, because it feels, I know what you're saying here, it can feel like it's not entirely satisfying, but I've commented before. I've worked at organizations where they put together a comment, you know, like an organization puts forward essentially a single letter as a comment. It's taken very seriously. It is a real venue to be heard and to say something. And even, you know, the folks who comment, they take it seriously too. So I know it can sound like, oh yeah, it's just a comment. Like, that's pretty cool. Like you said, they're legally obligated to read through them and to address concerns. It feels maybe not great, but it actually is. I would highly recommend folks to look it up, try it out.
Yeah, it makes you feel better. Like, you know, industry is definitely taking advantage of it. Industry is commenting. There are companies are doing it. They're hiring trade associations to do it to make sure they address every single issue. So they recognize it's important. And consumer groups are doing it, but like, we are under-resourced and understaffed. And so it often is helpful to have like a smart, curious person's like, who really cares about something, to like spend an hour or two like to drill into an issue no one else is thinking about. It can be really impactful.
Yeah. Justin, I wanted to thank you again for coming on today's show and for just explaining, like, there is some optimism in this world and there has been change. And so again, thank you for coming on today's show and showing all of this to us.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for having me on. I love talking about this stuff. And again, it's imperfect, but I think, you know, things are getting better in a lot of ways. And there's interest in making things better. It's hard, though. It's hard passing legislation and passing rules, especially around things like AI. And a lot of people want to do the right thing. So again, like, having interested, dedicated folks who want to help is always welcome.
To our listeners, we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Until then, stay tuned and stay safe. And remember, you can read all our cybersecurity coverage on Mauerbytes Labs at mauerbytes.com/blog. Finally, our intro music is by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com, and our outro music is by Woa from unminus.com. Today's show has been edited by our podcast consultant, Eric Johnson, at lightningpod.fm. Thank you, folks.